Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I think Hogan should have worn the wig from Halloween Havoc all the time. If the WWF wanted a scary black gladiator, they should have hired Shadow, and the fake Razor Ramon looked more like an ethnic Jimmy Nail than Scott Hall.
I'm G. John Chase, and word on the grapevine is that WWE Hall of Famer Sonny will be following the elusive footsteps of China by entering into the porn industry. Why not 1996 when she was hot? I bet it's like a wizard's sleeve or a kangaroo's pouch.
I'm Carl Jones, and as we head towards the end of 96, it's certainly sunny days as Slick Willie and Easy E are well on top. But enough about the Gold Club, let's get back to the Monday Night Wars.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and unfortunately this is my last SCG show. You may not realise these intros are actually recorded after the shows, and during today's show I got into a fist fight with G. John Chase over women's wrestling. So if you like me on the shows, email Liam and ask me to come back. If you don't, go fuck yourself as well.
This is the panel for the 40th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us break down the fourth quarter of 1996 and the Monday Night War next. Welcome to the 40th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Faggot Roads!
That needs a little bit of context, otherwise we're going to turn off a lot of people.
We did on the last show, didn't I?
A couple of shows ago. Carl Jones!
Poor Rhodes.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
I don't know what just happened, but it
so basically, yeah, we'll get to it in about four or five podcast times. It's a catcall from 1998 on Monday Night Raw, which does tie us into the fact that we are here to talk about Monday Nitro and Monday Night Raw head-to-head, the history of the Monday Night Wars. We talked about the third quarter of 1996 last week. We're here today to talk about the fourth quarter of 1996 with assistance, as always, from Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, as we have a lot of notes as we go through the timeline here that bring about a lot of interesting little bits and pieces of information, kind of allow us to look at it as we would now, kind of, you know, now we have these kind of everyday access to the internet and easy information. Back then we didn't really have that, so this kind of brings about a lot of different facts and figures that we may not have known. If you haven't heard one of our shows before, you can go back and listen to our archives by going to squaredcirclegazette.podbean.com or subscribe to us on iTunes at Squared Circle Gazette Radio. So we'll go straight ahead here. We're up to October in 1996, and let's kick it off. So from the Observer: the Bret Hart sweepstakes appears to have reached its 11th hour, and most likely nobody, perhaps including Bret Hart himself, knows for sure who is going to end up as the winner. While the WWF had been planning for Hart's return at the Survivor Series, and is already being advertised for a late November tour of England, WCW has countered with a strong offer which will be at least three times as much money as Hart has ever earned in wrestling, guaranteed. It appears WWF officials became quite concerned over the past week when they received word that WCW had made its huge offer, a three-year deal to Bret worth supposedly close to $9 million, one which the WWF couldn't afford to come close to even matching. So we'll kick off with this right away, because this is obviously the seeds of this were being sown in the last podcast last week. We heard there were rumors that WCW was going to make the big play. Interesting here to kind of get everybody's thoughts around the table about Bret's decision that he did make. We know that what decision he made ultimately, and we'll come to the actual the event when he announces it. We mentioned Davey Boy in the last podcast. This guy, WCW, was headhunting pretty hard, and they wanted him to be the fourth member of the NWO, and Davey Boy didn't take that deal. He took the lower offer. And in hindsight, I was thinking about this over the past week, Davey Boy probably should have taken the bigger offer. They should have taken the money while it was there, because they would have been able to go back, most likely, if the time and spot was there for him.
Well, like the old booking adage in what the fight game is, with the fights they deliver kind of thing, you know, take the guaranteed money. And yeah, I mean, with that money on the table, all of them are silly not to take it, really.
Yeah. Well,
the only thing I would say in Bret's defence here is that whilst the numbers aren't as eye-watering in terms of money from the WWF, he does get that longer contract, doesn't he, at least? There's a bit of a trade-off there, so I can see in a sense why he would have lent towards the WWF, and obviously his loyalties that play into that. But in terms of Davey, absolutely. What are the WWF really going to do with you that they haven't already done with you?
Yeah.
You know, just go, take the money, and as you say, you know, there's no bridges burnt there, really. There's always the chance to come back in wrestling.
Yeah, in terms of Bulldog, I mean, it probably really didn't matter with him. I mean, how many times did he go back and forth between WWF and WCW in the 90s?
But he never got the guaranteed offer. He never got the guaranteed money deal that he would have got had he jumped at that initial period of time, that $400,000 a year guaranteed, because WWF signed him for $250,000, and when WCW took him in after the Montreal situation, Bischoff didn't pay them more than they were already getting.
And let's bear in mind, for him to leave the WWF that second time round, he had to pay for his own release anyway, which I believe is six figures. Yeah,
$100,000.
I just feel it's more like a kind of like, I think he's worth this much, but we're going to pay this much because we want him. Not that we need him, we want him because Vince wanted him.
Well, that's all it comes down to at the end of the day. It wasn't so much about getting former WWF talent. It was a case of, in much the same way that Vince had done with the AWA years previously, how can we screw with the competition? You know, WCW are well ahead in the ratings. There's nothing to suggest that they need Davey Boy to help cement them at that time. But it's just another way to twist the knife into Vince.
Yeah.
I mean, realistically, if Bulldog had gone, would he have been much higher than Virgil on the fucking prestige stakes of the NWO? But what it does do, maybe it is worth the money, maybe not, is the stigma of you got these guys all leaving. It's just prestige thing. It's just another nail in their eyes at that time in the WF's coffin. You know, with momentum all completely one direction. So, is that financially, would it be financially worth it? Maybe not. It's maybe hard to put a value on that kind of prestige and stigma at the time, but.
Yeah, and obviously to bring this back to Brett, which is what we started here at the beginning of October, where he's been made this deal, you have to think that Vince is shitting bricks. Shawn Michaels is struggling with the Monday Night ratings to really gain any kind of a foothold with the audience, and Bret Hart, who you have to think is the most established star he's got, may be going elsewhere. So you can see, and as we'll get to, why he made the offer that he made, although he did end up regretting it, as it turns out.
He was kind of all falling into kind of Bret Hart's hands a little bit, you know. He manages to get to, you know, the summer off. He goes off to do some other things.
Lonesome Dove.
And all that stuff that he was hoping was going to, you know, take off. Yeah, right. You know, and in the meantime, you know, this was a bit of a kind of roll of the dice on the luck front. But, you know, the company isn't doing too well still without him. And as you said, Shawn Michaels' run isn't kind of, you know, holding any water. So it's just like, in the meantime, you know, Vince is just thinking, well, the one guy who I've always been able to resort back to for the last several years, and now the WCW are turning around and offering him ridiculous contracts. Well, Vince, I'll be fucking worried too.
The story of the Monday Night War so far, for the first time, it's the wrestler's market. Moving on here, Ric Flair is expected to be out the rest of the year due to a torn rotator cuff which needs surgery. While nothing has been done to set this up, it is believed that Jeff Jarrett will take his spot within the Four Horsemen. I bring this up just because Jeff Jarrett was the guy, maybe next to Paul Romo, who was the most lampooned on the Four Horsemen DVD as being a guy who was unworthy of being a horseman, which I thought was...
I don't know, they did a job on Sid pretty well as well.
Yeah, well, you know, they... well...
Sid kind of did that to himself.
More on Sid later.
Wasn't it Ric Flair on that DVD that turns around and he absolutely buries Sid and he goes, you can put that on the DVD. I want you to put that on the DVD. He had no business being with us.
I reckon you should give old Jeffrey a call, Lee, and see what his opinion on the matter was. How does he feel about the Horseman, yeah,
get him back on the show, see if he wants to.
Still got him on speed dial.
Yeah. Sweet. It was your booking decision, Bischoff. If you didn't like it, you shouldn't have done it in the first place. October 7th, Nitro. An angle was done where Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Six, and the Giant supposedly attacked Ric Flair with a baseball bat for the storyline explanation of his upcoming absence. Randy Savage is yet again beaten down in front of Elizabeth. Randy Savage did a promo not talking about the angle, but that Slim Jim's car finished in 10th, but the NWO car crashed in a NASCAR race. So Savage, he's been kind of a little bit off the beaten path here when it comes to his promo since the start of the NWO angle. Hasn't turned it around quite yet. Jeff Jarrett did debut on the show beating Hugh Morris. Rick Steiner versus Chris Benoit was the last match on the show, with another NWO beatdown of Randy Savage, as we mentioned. This does have the great spot where the Giant is carrying Randy Savage up the stairs and then he slips off the stairs and drops Savage, which is just fucking horrible looking. But over on Raw, Sid, who we just mentioned there, beats Goldust with the powerbomb. Notable just because Goldust, who was such a topic of discussion for us during the first half of 1996, has been completely phased down at this point. It's mentioned in the Observer that there was actually a directive to kind of nullify Goldust as a hot character, because, yeah, and you saw it here with Raw Championship Friday. He gets pinned clean by Shawn. He's lost to The Undertaker at this point. He's lost to Ahmed. Lost to Sid here. After all the heat from the Village Voice.
I was going to say, is this because the Village is pissed?
Yeah, because, so the whole deal was, obviously, there'd been so much negative press about Goldust, they just decided, all right, enough of this. Let's just kind of knock this one on the head. Interesting note here, the WWF bought two commercials in most of the country to air while Nitro was on. The first aired 4 minutes before the show, telling viewers to make the switch to Raw, and a second commercial aired about 9:45, trying to get them to switch to the final quarter hour. It was all for naught. WCW did a 3.5 to Raw's 2.1. The gap in the final quarter for the Benoit Steiner finish and the NWO angle was a 3.7. Sid and Goldust only did a 2.0 in their quarter hour.
Well, maybe Raw would have dropped below a 2 if they hadn't, so we never know, I guess.
I suppose so. It appears at this point that the odds are at least decent that Randy Savage will be through with WCW shortly after Halloween Havoc. I can't believe he goes through all this abuse every week without getting the belt, adds Dave Meltzer. So Savage's contract is coming up, and yeah, so there you go. It's considered at this time that Savage is not long for the world of WCW.
He must have realised there's no fucking chance in hell he would have gone back to
Wrestler's Market considered. This is the
Wrestler's Market, and despite the urban myths, let's call them, Vince, in sort of the blind panic he was at the time, I could see him possibly, you know, biting the sort of proverbial carrot to get Savage back. If for no other reason, just to sort of stop the rot and try and negate that perception as best he could.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we said before, that momentum all going in one direction, so it's at least a chance to pull something back.
And Savage is a featured guy in WCW. That's not, make no bones about it. He's one of the key guys on the WCW side here in this storyline that they're kind of relying on. So yeah, by no means do I think that this is a one option kind of a situation.
It would just be really kind of weird. I know Vince is a lot of things. But just to completely
nice emphasis on that.
Just to completely change, just go a complete 180 to turn around and state from what his original opinion was back in 1992-93 that Savage has passed it and shouldn't really be working anymore. He should be on maybe on the mic or something like that. But also just the fact that if he brought him back, this is the same guy that for the last several months was running those vignettes.
The Nacho Man.
Nacho Man and the Huckster.
Yeah, you know, and think then, he would have taken Hogan in a heartbeat as well.
Yeah, that's the sort of... Oh, it's just... He can't be that much of an ass.
Of a businessman.
Yeah,
of a
businessman.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He bought in Eric Bischoff. Yes, he is.
That's why you love it or hate it's the fact he's the best at what he does as a businessman. Wrestling businessman, that's Vince McMahon. Yeah, He'll do anything.
He'll do anything. He certainly will. There is more and more behind-the-scenes heat in the Hogan, Hall, and Nash camp, not to mention the disenchantment from those not in the camp. Hall and Nash are tired of playing background vocals, and they're mad about the amount of money that Hogan's making. So it's begun. So all the nonsense that you can hear for the next History of the Monday Night War podcast that we do, it starts here. It didn't take long, three months.
The ball is now rolling.
Yeah, I'm surprised we had to wait this long.
Yeah, well, there was kind of talk initially as it happened how Hogan is completely overshadowing Hall and Nash, just because of the fact that he's it's the fact that Hogan, the biggest babyface of all time, turning heel, was more important than Hall and Nash in terms of the way that the angles were driven anyway, certainly. Hall and Nash clearly not very happy about that fact. Because they very quickly went from the two guys in fading and headlined the pay-per-view to wrestling the fucking Faces of Fear and the Nasty Boys while Hogan's in the main events. They're still important to TV, but they're nowhere near as key as Hogan.
So I said it last week, it was the emphasis of the NWA subtly changed when Hogan joined it. And this is just coming to fruition now, with Hoagie taking the lead.
Yeah,
Hoagie Bear. Is it any me you called him that? Obviously so.
We move to October 14th. On Monday Night Raw, we get a Mr. Perfect promo for his upcoming match, his return to action against Triple H next week. They've been doing the teases for weeks now, where Mr. Perfect has been taking away Triple H's ladies, or Hunter Hearst Helmsley's ladies, not yet Triple H. Although, actually, this is the promo, I think, where Mr. Perfect calls him Triple H for the first time, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a little bit of a tie-in for you there. Headlined by Austin versus Michaels. For the first time on TV, we get a run in from Vader, Savio Vega, Psycho Sid, the fake Razor and Diesel watch on as the chaos ensues. That's pretty much how Raw ends. But
Savio Vega's involved.
Well, it's great. So basically, Vader runs in to attack Michaels.
Yeah,
Savio runs
that.
In to make the save. Austin immediately gives him a stunner and he rolls out the ring, and that's it.
Those well-known friends, Savio Vega and Shawn Michaels.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, that's Raw this week on Nitro. Pretty good show. We get a Hogan promo, and in news that I'm sure you'll love, the Nasty Boys get the shit kicked out of them by the NWO.
Yeah,
they tease at the end that the Nasties were joining the NWO for a few weeks here, and this is the Hogan does the thing where you haven't signed the contracts, you don't wear our colours promo, and the Nasty Boys get the shit beaten out of them, much to my delight. Also on the show, Savage came out for an interview and they showed a tape of Elizabeth begging for forgiveness and saying she still loved him as much as she did when she said I do. Savage nearly cried, didn't say a word, and left the building without saying a word. It was the best work Savage has done since joining the company. This angle is fucking brilliant. Savage is so awesome in this segment.
It is beautiful, and it brought a tear to my eye as well. It's the quintessential man who lost the love of his life, and he's never going to get her back, and he knows he's probably at fault, and it's been dangled in front of him, and he's not sure. He's just not sure what to do. He would give anything to have her back, but he doesn't.
He knows it's not
talking about the angle in real life.
Well, exactly.
That's the beauty of it. The tie-in is the beauty of it.
Hogan is great for this month as the shit disturber. But this weekend next, as we'll get to, of Hogan just being the complete asshole dangling this carrot in front of Savage, knowing that this is going to bother him more than anything else. And Savage is just so great. And what makes it is the fact that he's not wearing his glasses on the promo and you can see his eyes. Because his eyes and his face, it just tells the story. Oh, Savage is superb in this segment.
He just sold it so beautifully. I was always kind of confused as to why he always felt he needed to wear the shades, and didn't let his eyes do more of the talking.
He was on autopilot for a lot of this stuff. I mean, that's the truth. Again, massive difference from one week to the next, where he's talking about the NASCAR race instead of talking about the world title shot and the serious angle. And the next week we get this absolute gem from Savage. It's like, I don't know what it was, but I guess it was just the direction. They actually drew something out of him that was real and different, and he wasn't just phoning it in.
Just quickly, Liz on her sex swing was pretty good as well.
On the sex swing? Sex swing on the woods? Nitro did a 3.2 this week to Raw's 1.8, the lowest rating in the history of Raw for Steve Austin versus Shawn Michaels.
See, I told you, drop below a 2 if they didn't have advertising.
Sid and Goldust, that's where it's at. WWF trailed during the middle of the show by only a half point, only to have WCW blister them by a whopping 3.4 to 1.7, as WCW had the Hogan monologue with the NWO beating up the Nasty Boys, going head to head with Shawn versus Austin. So 1.7 for Shawn and Austin. How things would change when that match is done again in the future.
Yeah, and just it's a further emphasis that despite what revisionist history would tell you, Austin was not a made man after that King of the Ring promo.
No, absolutely not. That Sunday, it's Buried Alive, October 20th.
Well, the ratings are already there.
And the buy rates will get there too as we come to now. 9,600 fans in the building, 100,000 buys, a 0.4. Not the worst buy rate they've done all year, but pretty damn close. This is close to international incident for the worst buy rate of the year.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, this was in Indiana, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was in Indiana, where the Pacers play basketball.
Yeah.
So, you say 9,000?
9,649.
So, we're talking there, if memory serves me correctly, a good round 7,000 shy of a full house there.
Yeah, not too good.
I really enjoyed the match and that.
How about Jim Ross's promo on this show?
Jim Ross's promo on this is a thing of beauty. I'm sure everyone around this table thoroughly enjoyed it, as he gets on the mic and just gives Vince the biggest tongue lashing of his life.
And Vince would remember it forever.
Oh yes, it was added to the list.
It was great. JR basically takes over a Doc Hendricks interview with Sid and makes fun of all the softball questions he's about to ask him. So that's a nice touch too. Sid pins Vader to get a shot at Survivor Series, the Survivor Series match with Shawn that Vader was promised. You may remember on the last podcast, Vader was promised the World Championship. The original plan was for Vader to beat Sid at the Buried Alive show and to beat Michaels at Survivor Series, says Dave Meltzer. Here's another thing too. Remember we mentioned Farouk was filmed taping promos with the Intercontinental title. Mm-hmm. Vader and Farouk were both told that they had to switch the original plans and not give them the belts because J.J. Dillon was at the meetings where those long-term plans were made, and obviously he had left the company and gone to WCW. As a result, they had to change all the storylines he knew. This is Vince's
beautiful,
I know,
excuse.
Vincent Mann can coin a fucking web of deceit whenever he has to.
Poor Big Leon.
Poor Farouk.
This
as well,
is pretty okay. much this is pretty much the end of Vader being treated like a top guy.
He's just a fat piece of shit.
that's where it would come to in the end. One night later, Bret Hart agrees to the 20-year contract with the World Wrestling Federation just prior to making the announcement of his returning on the live Raw. As late as after the pay-per-view show, he was still entertaining offers from not just Bischoff and McMahon, but he's also called by Kevin Nash and Scott Hall attempting to convince him to join WCW. Scott Hall even agreed to waive his favored nation's contractual clause as a way for Bischoff to increase the offer to Bret even another level without having to give Hall and Nash big raises. So Bret makes his decision here. Vince's offer is a 20-year deal, the lifetime contract, $1.5 million for, I want to say, 3 years before it's a lower level after that. But yeah, the whole idea is that Bret's there for life. And on the promo, you get to see Vince.
Vince ham it up as only Vince can.
Like he didn't know.
And this is the promo as well when he calls Steve Austin best wrestler in the world.
Yeah, very interesting.
And says he'll take him on at Survivor Series. And now Steve gets some momentum that we all thought came from King of the Ring if you listen to WWE's version of events, but it's not, it's the Bret Hart.
Yeah, it is. As soon as this happens, things start moving in motion.
And let's not forget all those Pullman fans around the table, the almost sort of schoolboy like jump up and down with glee that Pillman does when Brett announces.
I love Pillman during this period of time because he's such a mark for Brett. That's like the angle. It's like he wanted to bring Brett back. It wouldn't work, so he buried him. And then as soon as he does come back, he marks out for him again. It's just hilarious. Also on this Raw, a pretty loaded one, the Mr. Perfect heel turn on this show where it's supposed to be Perfect versus Triple H. Triple H injures Perfect's leg. Mark Mero takes his place for the Intercontinental Championship, and then Perfect turns on Mark Mero with a chair shot. Triple H is your new Intercontinental Champion, and Mr. Perfect to heel once again.
And to be around for about a couple of weeks longer, and that's about it. Yeah.
We'll come to that. Over on Nitro, a pretty boring show, says Dave Meltzer. Flair did a promo putting over Jeff Jarrett in order to lead the Four Horsemen in his absence. The NWO did an angle where the imposter Sting is wrestling JL, and the real Sting comes out dressed in black and white for the first time and beats up the imposter and puts him in the Scorpion Deathlock. All the NWO guys were there, but none of them helped out the fake Sting. Afterwards, they asked him to join the NWO, and Sting says the only thing that's for sure about Sting is that nothing's for sure, and this is the last time that Sting will talk until 1998.
I've always heard that kind of rumour, though, it was Scott Hall's idea. Does anyone know if that was true?
Yeah, well, basically the story goes that there was a party that everybody had gone to in WCW beforehand, and Kevin Nash was dressed as the Crow, and Scott Hall, who didn't know what the Crow was, pointed to Kevin Nash dressed as the Crow and said, "This is what you should do. You should be dressed like that. You should be all in black. You should be da 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 da."
I can understand, obviously, that they wanted to go with a darker look, you know, to move away from the surfer dude kind of hat thing like that. But why something specifically about the Crow? Because it's not like a thing that he kind of looks a little bit like him. It's a blatant rip-off.
Not at this point it isn't. Not at this point. They haven't quite got the look down to a Tifa Sting at this point. He's not got the longer hair. It's still short. Yeah. The face paint isn't quite what you would see in the coming months. And obviously the fact that he spoke.
Yeah.
You know, most importantly. So there's the semblance of an idea there, but it hasn't really, really
fully
fleshed out yet. Yeah.
It does feel like a natural, organic evolution though, because for me, just from his hair, because he wasn't blonde anymore. He was brown, coming out a bit longer, so it's starting to get there for him.
This is the go home show for Halloween Havoc, and the main event is Savage versus Benoit, which doesn't happen. Savage comes out dressed in a black leather with fringe everywhere, looking like he's just off the set of Wild Wild West, actually, now that I think about it.
Awesome.
And basically, just again, Bischoff's trying to press him for comments on the Liz thing last week. We cut to an NWO video where Hogan, who has a full head of hair, as he's filming Three Ninjas on Mega Mountain, whatever the fuck that film was called. And he basically, it's like the expose that Hogan's the one that's prodding Liz to do this, and you need to act better, you need to act better, I'll teach you how to act, you know. I want Savage's head on a platter, do you want this, you know. Hogan basically using Liz again to manipulate Savage is the whole idea here. We go back live, and Savage, who doesn't want to say a word, walks away, changes his mind, comes back, and a very simple, quiet delivery to talk about how things are fragile, business is fragile, marriages can be fragile, and Hulk Hogan, life is fragile, and leaves, and that's the end of the show, and it's great. It's like this is actually a good set. The last 2 weeks of this are pretty good stuff.
We've also got Bischoff subtly doing his little thing, and the guys on the other commentators were like questioning, where's Bischoff? And it's like these little seeds there. It's actually really good storytelling and foreshadowing.
It's a sense of sort of the long term vision and foreshadowing that you wouldn't get in later years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. Just to see how this panned out, Nitro with a 3.2 to Raw's 2.6. The Bret Hart interview proved to be a major channel switcher, while WWF rose from a 2.5 to a 3. The first quarter hour in a long time where the WWF actually had the edge. So there you go. Although Nitro does win the night in the end, so they still have the momentum in their pocket.
I bet Sean didn't like that.
I bet he absolutely didn't like that. You can imagine the state of mind.
Is he fit backstage?
He has to. You can imagine what everybody's saying and what he's thinking in his own insecure mind at the time. And it just had to have been driving the guy crazy.
And he's starting to see it as well, I think, with Sean.
Yeah, the cracks are starting to show, even on TV, on some of these matches. Based on the recent arrivals to the WWF, says Dave Meltzer, one really wonders about the seriousness of the drug policy nowadays. More on that later. Rumours of Savage and Hogan leaving WCW and taking their programme to the WWF also come around this week. Hogan was claimed to have received a monstrous offer from the WWF in the ballpark of $5 million per year. Hogan, however, decided he was going to stay on his current deal at 3 years on the same deal with WCW. Reinforces leverage, basically.
Yeah. I would imagine so. As much as we said before that Vince would have taken Hogan back in a heartbeat, I'm not sure he could have afforded to take him back at $5 million a year.
Not especially after the Brett deal, which was a bit of a strenuous one in itself.
Question. Let's say that he did have the money to get to buy Hogan. Do you think he would have given Hogan the same privileges that Bischoff did, as in the creative control?
Didn't listen to it. I was just thinking of Destiny's Child when you said question. Anyway.
At least he didn't follow up with tell me what you think about this.
Yeah. Was that
but,
the
lyric? Damn it.
Yeah. More than that, I'd say, wasn't he getting a slice of
pay-per-view pie, yeah, which he wouldn't have got with the WWF.
The direction the two companies are going, he'd be crazy to leave.
Which brings us to Halloween Havoc on October 27th. 10,000 fans in the building, $69,000 in merchandise, half of which was the NWO, a 0.7 buy rate for 174,000 buys. So this is actually up from the previous few pay-per-views. WCW sets its all-time record for both live gate and souvenir sales on the show. And I should say, after the last 2 weeks where we praised Savage, a fucking terrible main event here. A comedy match after the great fucking build they've done. Super serious. You got Savage taking Hogan's wig off and putting it on his head, putting his sunglasses on and acting like a fool. And it's like,
The monster truck bit at the start,
yeah,
as well.
It
just completely undercuts the emotion of everything. And yeah, WrestleMania 5, this is not.
No, Dave Meltzer calls this the ghost of Hulk Hogan pinned the corpse of Randy Savage. So that should pretty much tell you where this match stood in Dave Meltzer's opinion at the time. Anyway, also of note, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash win the tag team titles on this show, and Rowdy Roddy Piper debuts, doing an undisciplined in-ring dialogue with Hulk Hogan that saw the 3-hour satellite time actually expire before the two finished.
I was going to say, a lot has been made in retrospect of Warrior's rambling promo a couple of years later. This one, to me, is in many ways worse, because whilst it doesn't go as long as Warrior's 28-minute diatribe does, Piper is just completely all over the shop. You're not even sure if he's really promoting a match of any kind.
No, Hogan too. Hogan's completely off the wall on this one. He's interrupting him. They're kind of jumping over each other all the time.
Yeah, you've got Piper calling, doesn't he calls the Giant Jolly Green, and it just...
Yeah.
Now, in the case of WCW at this point, they're getting so hot and the name recognition is such that it doesn't affect them.
Many within WCW are seeing Piper as something of a replacement for Randy Savage, whose contract expires in a few weeks and still hasn't signed, as the two sides can't agree on Savage wanting to work a much more limited schedule. Another note from the Observer: Monday Night Raw will be moving up 1 hour to 7:57 Eastern Time on the USA Network starting November the 4th, going head to head with WCW Nitro's first hour as opposed to its second hour. WCW no longer will have the 1 hour lead in to tease and build for the second hour, which goes head to head, which has been quite the edge for Nitro to be able to set things up.
Obviously, this is pre-TiVo, because who the fuck would start at 7:57 in this day and age, surely?
I know. They're trying to get that any kind of jump they can, 3-minute lead-in, you know? So there you go. On Nitro the next night, they pretty much show the entire Piper-Hogan confrontation, undisciplined as it was. Over on Raw, we have Shawn versus Davey Boy Smith and a Bret Hart-Steve Austin face-to-face to set up Survivor Series. Nothing really of major note on either of these two shows,
I
don't think.
Was the face-to-face? Was that the both guys? It wasn't...
Is it both guys in the studio?
It wasn't. No. Steve Austin was in the studio because he was pissed off that he was in the studio, but they went to Bret's house, and next week they're going to Pillman's house.
Yeah. I mean, that was going to happen.
This right now, Steve Austin, it just clicked.
It's gathering a bit of momentum. It's finally starting to gather a bit of pace, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Austin's really come to life. Absolutely. As soon as this happens,
it's like a light. Now the light's gone on. It's and if WCW, the lore of that was to tune in and see what the NWO did. This now, it's Austin is really becoming the WWF's NWO, and that what's Austin going to do this week? Or at least I'm not sure. Maybe it wasn't so clear cut at the time. Maybe, but watching it back, it's like, oh god, this is so entertaining. Even watching them back, it's like, I just want to see what Austin's going to do next week.
And to that point, backtracking slightly to last week's podcast, where you mentioned about the sort of the back and forth that Vince was having in terms of the product going edgier or still trying to maintain what has been his sort of more traditional forte. And with Austin here, this is where you start to see that more edgy element coming in, particularly as it pertains to next week.
Yeah, or even this week, so when he yells at the woman doing the makeup about how she needs to hit the streets in that outfit, and then he attacks the guy who's counting him down. He's like,
counts me down!
Yeah. And you go, listen to this shit no more! He just throws the guy into the big, the metal stairs, and it's just great stuff.
It was when I was like watching these kind of highlights and seeing like the letter S in front of Hitman and all that stuff, and him in the studios just like ripping into everyone, that I just thought, like, okay, now I got it. I wish I kind of saw this first. I wish I saw a heel Austin before I saw babyface Austin, and I would have got like the whole characterization. But
it was all the feud of Bret, And you know, credit for Brett for putting Austin over in what he said and just allowing him to work with him in the way he did. But Austin totally ran with the ball. This was the chance he'd been waiting for. Working with Brett totally gave him the legitimacy, but he totally ran with the ball. And just to go back to what you said, G, about the about seeing Austin as the heel, I think maybe in later years, even though he was great and that's when he made the money, he was kind of living, it was almost a cliche, not cliche, that's too harsh a term, along those lines of what he'd done previously as the heel. That was really
setting
the premise for the character, in kind of how everyone remembers NWO as, like, you know, the invasion angle, but that only lasted itself for, you know, a couple of months. But that's kind of the premise for the whole gimmick, and I think I've watching it back, I felt the same with Austin as well. This now really sets the stage from which he'll build on going forward. So.
Yeah, great stuff here from Austin. Nitro did a 3.5, Divorce 2.0, so they're still not gaining any more traction.
It's funny, I wonder, having got that sort of initial jump, if you like, or that initial spark from the re-signing of Brett and Brett's interview being a ratings winner in isolation for them, I'd have been curious as to sort of be a fly on the wall in Vince's house, just imagine what his reaction would be to that number the
2.0
following week.
2.0 the next week.
Yeah, you're back to where you were. And, oh, by the way, you're now on hock to Bret Hart for the next 20 years.
No wonder he's pissed off. Brian Pillman had ankle surgery this week. They did the angle the night before, which aired on Superstars, where Steve Austin destroyed his ankle because he thought that Brian Pillman was putting over Bret Hart. Not necessarily Monday Night War implications, but we're just talking about Steve Austin revving up his character here. He also has his live wire spot here around this period of time, and he's just absolutely fantastic.
Is that the cane?
Oh yeah, yeah, come on. Yeah, for some reason I think it's like Glenn Jacobs.
And puts the foot in the chair.
And famously Pillmanizes him.
That looks brutal.
Yeah, really fantastic stuff here. Again, just another notch on Austin's belt here to kind of give him a little bit more credibility. Pillman's out. Pillman, who'd been signed in June and really hasn't had a chance to do that much. He was supposed to be back around this time. Ankle didn't heal properly. Has to have it fused in one place, unfortunately.
And also, very quickly, we said previously, what was so great about the NWO when it came on was how different it was to everything else we'd seen in wrestling for years. Austin was exactly the same.
Yeah,
it take time for him, but he was so different. And that's
November the 4th. The show opens up with Sting in the rafters. Bischoff is not on commentary here. He goes to Portland to try and meet with Roddy Piper to try and sign the Hogan Piper match. Luger versus Booker T is the last match on the show, but the actual main event slot is Hulk Hogan doing a promo in the ring, showing a clip of him in Santa with muscles.
Cool.
Don't you know?
Creative control.
Yeah. November 4th on Raw, however, we get the Steve Austin, Brian Pillman gun angle. What does everybody think about this? Because this caused a lot of controversy at the time, obviously. WWF had to apologise for this afterwards. Yeah. And apologise to the USA Network, who got a lot of flack because of the gunshots that were used and the fact that Pillman dropped an F-bomb in there.
Get out of the fucking way! Before going to actual segment, in terms of retrospect, I always kind of laugh at like the hullabaloo that was going over the guns, because like, just in my head I keep thinking, like, wait till you get to the necrophilia angle. It's like a stupid thing to do within like the confines of, you know, the wrestling business, but like I wasn't like shocked and appalled by it.
I'm not saying, by the way, that I was greatly offended by any means. I absolutely love the angle. I think it's brilliant.
You went and bought a gun the next day, didn't you?
I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
Whilst I'm not, was never personally offended, but I can see why it would upset some people. Obviously, USA got a lot of heat for it, but I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And just a little hat tip to Kevin Kelly, who's not someone I've ever given much love to, but I think he's quite good in this angle as well as the sort of the panic-stricken interviewer.
What do you think about the Steve Austin beating up his friends outside?
That was the best part for me, goddamn.
He threw the one in the kiddie pool.
He's trying to drown him in the foot in the kiddie pool.
He tried to drown one in the kiddie
pool. But my favourite thing,
he just picks up like a little toy sort of bike or Tonka truck, so just lobs it at the one, just smacks him straight in the head.
My favourite is the guy when he's got like he's pushing the car door on the guy's head.
Yeah.
As he's about to stop, a guy attacks him from behind. If you watch the tape, he like leans forward and actually like almost cuts the guy's ear off with the door. It's ridiculous.
It cuts away and then it goes back to Kevin Kelly, and then you say, and Austin's come back. Yeah. Oh my god, he's back.
That's great. Austin screaming, shoot me.
Yeah. I say in retrospect, it's easy to say, but did anyone think Austin was a heel in these things? Because he's just so damn entertaining every single week. I mean, was he trying to be a heel?
Yeah. Oh, well, the story was that Pillman would always tell him, "You're a babyface kid. You're a babyface kid," right. And Austin would hate it.
Hated it. Yeah. Oh, wow. But it's funny that I can understand where Kieran's coming from. Austin, whilst supposedly being a heel, isn't doing any doesn't have any of the character traits you would normally associate with a heel. He's not cowering away. He's not playing chicken shit. He's playing a badass.
Yeah.
And like you said before, it's so different to everything else that the WWF had served up prior to that. In many respects, it's sort of the he's the lead example of them finding their, pardon the pun, attitude.
Okay, now this is a curious thing though. You mentioned that. How much of a leap do you think this is from the desperation of the fake Razor and the fake Diesel that we've just seen? Because, I mean, this was shock value for the sake of trying to pop a rating and trying to get back on track after the 2.0 last week. Mm. I don't see it. I mean, other than the fact that the personalities involved, which makes it a lot cooler, and the performances themselves, the underlying intention is still the same.
It is, and by no means would I suggest that this was a game changer by any means. It's just, I think it's just a nice sort of example and a nice platform to show Pillman's character traits and to sort of add fuel to the fire for Austin.
So, after all this talk, after this legendary angle, the ratings. Nitro does a 3.4 for the Santa with muscles plaid Nitro. To Raw's 2.3. WCW had a full point lead at 3-2 when they did the tease where Pillman pulled out the gun and the signal went out. Did make a significant difference as the third quarter saw them go neck and neck with a 2.8. But WCW for the final quarter hour picked up to a 3.2 while WWF dropped to a 2.5. The final 15 minutes on Nitro was the first time that WCW beat the WWF with the kids' audience as 125,000 kids turned to Nitro. So you have to, and we talked about this previously, this kind of flirting with both sides that Vince was doing all year long. This is the reason why you can see why he didn't necessarily go full bore, because by doing it he's thinking, if I can't attract the adult audience but the kids go away as a result, I'm left with nothing. That's pretty much the case here.
Santa with muscles is the last segment on your show, but it just goes to show, when you're hot there's an awful lot you can get away with.
Yeah.
And when you're cold, and in the case of Raw, as much as we all enjoy that segment and think it was really good, it's not got enough to sort of break through because of what's gone before it.
The plan right now is to do NWO Monday Nitro head-to-head with Raw and WCW Monday Nitro in the second hour. So they've still got this idea in their head of doing the NWO as its own brand, as its own show kind of a thing. Yeah. One of the reasons they did this angle with Sting is that he has a maximum amount of dates per year in his contract, and WCW only had a few dates left, and they needed him for major house shows, so they had to get him off as much TV and minor house shows as possible. So the creation of this angle originally was actually in part to make sure that they didn't overshoot the Sting contract.
And we're also seeing there some of the issues that arise from these contracts, which when they're first signed are all great for everyone concerned, and when business is doing fine, it's not a problem. But you're seeing some of the limitations that can come from these, I'll go with ironclad contracts.
Speaking of questionable ironclad contracts, Mark Henry suffered a broken leg in training bouncing off the ropes. I'm not sure that the $2.5 million invested in Mark Henry will go down in history as one of Vince McMahon's better investments, says Dave Meltzer.
If I'm not mistaken, wasn't he also signed to a 10-year deal?
10 years at $250,000 apiece, guaranteed. Well, after that contract ended, you know, he got pretty good for a little while there, but it took him a while. Funny to mention Mark Henry. You may remember Mark Henry as the gentleman who said that the WWF was more honest competition than Olympics because of the drug testing. Let's get to the drug testing. Here's a nice segue. A few weeks back, the WWF sent a memo to its wrestlers. As a result of our drug testing program, the incidence of use of illegal and performance-enhancing drugs is so slight that group testing is no longer cost-effective or necessary. Thus, we are, effective immediately, suspending drug collection and testing on a group basis. So the guy that had the balls to fucking call out Ted Turner for his having no steroid policy at the start of the year in the Billionaire Ted skits is now, of course, not doing steroid testing. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, coincidentally, not long after he's re-signed the Bulldog as well.
November 11th, Nitro, Gene Oakland returns. He'd been out of the company for a little while after he didn't get his $420,000 a year deal renewed.
Scheme Gene.
Hall and Nash ask DDP to join the NWO for the first time here, and Scott Hall and Larry Zbyszko start some heat, which is the beginning of some sort of an angle to build up for a Zbyszko-Hall match, which actually, they took a good while to actually get to the payoff. They also aired a Roddy Piper music video from 1992 that looked like something that Ed Wood would produce.
Zbyszko won okay, that probably might be a bit of a kind of Marmite for some people. But the DDP one, with them trying to obviously coach him into joining the NWO, by this point, I thought this was a great setup for DDP into...
Nice moving, slow burn.
It's a nice slow burn, into and also into moving DDP up into that upper area of the card as well.
Agree completely.
I know this is going to offend you, Chase, but watching these back, I remembered I'd never give a shit about DDP.
Really?
Yeah.
I did. I was a big DDP fan. Really? I love the Diamond Cur.
Good move. Yeah, that's a good move. I just thought it looked like a dirty, scutty old man.
Guess he was a
dirty. Yes, he was. Yeah.
That's true. Was.
Over on Raw, we get Sid and Shawn Michaels as a team going up against Bulldog and Owen. Obviously, there's babyface dissension here to set up a Survivor Series. Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Bob Holly goes on last with another Bret Hart Steve Austin face-off to tease Survivor Series. Yeah, you say that, but Bob Holly versus Steve Austin is a 2.5 for Raw this week, so take that, Sid and Goldust. To Nitro's 3.5, so again, another 1-point victory for WCW here. Mankind and Terry Gordy is the execution we put together as a tag team. Talk about something that didn't last very long.
Yeah,
it's so depressing when you watch the Terry Gordy stuff from the Freebirds, and then he's brought in as the executioner. I understand he'd had his health issues.
Was it a stroke?
Was it a coma?
He'd gone into a coma. He was never the same afterwards. And you'd question why you would sign Terry Gordy to then put him in a mask.
Yeah, tricky.
You could have had anyone in that role, really.
They signed him because he had a short run in ECW.
Yes.
And that was kind of, you know, Heyman worked his magic and made people think he could still go.
Yeah, he'd had the match with Raven where he first came back, where everybody popped huge from his ECW arena. But the match with Raven itself, even though it was all smoke and mirrors, and it was a Raven booking mega fest that he would like to do at the time, Gordy looked like he was half decent, and people actually bought into Gordy again. So yeah, it appears that Kurt Hennig may be the latest wrestler to switch affiliations to WCW. Hennig met with Eric Bischoff late last week, and the two sides apparently reached a verbal agreement on a deal where Hennig would return as an active wrestler. Hennig no-showed a WWF personal appearance and the Survivor Series pay-per-view, which we'll come to shortly. He was a very short time away from a lifetime disability settlement on his Lloyd's of London policy, which would have paid him a reported $300,000 lump sum, and the WWF fucked him out of it completely. What happened was, when they were doing this whole tease with Mr. Perfect maybe wrestling Triple H, and Perfect was kind of in two minds of whether he was going to wrestle in the future because his policy was coming up and he was going to get the life sum, Bruce Pritchard was the person whose signature was on the paper, which he later denied until Mr. Perfect actually showed him the document with his name on it. But it was Bruce Pritchard that sent the note to Lloyd's of London that they were considering having him wrestle again. And by virtue of Hennig telling his employers that he could, they thought, well, by that merit, you can't be disabled for life. There you go. Hennig doesn't get the 300 grand, goes to WCW as a result. Which does take us very naturally to Survivor Series. 18,600 fans at MSG, a 0.58 buy rate for 145,000 buys. Sid wins the WWF title, ending the reign of Shawn Michaels.
Woo!
No.
No. It was no irony.
Yeah, well, I'm glad.
though the Madison Square Garden did.
I know. And I don't know if it's because they were so anti Shawn, if it's they're so pro Sid. But there's a lot of
charismatic, you see.
No,
the New Yorkers love
Sid.
They
love the chin
of the psycho.
No, they did like him though. It's got nothing to do with pro Sid and everything to do with anti Michaels.
Really, but Sid. Well, did get pops in ECW, remember, as well, and it's a similar audience.
Yeah, but oh, come on, let's not get down this garden path of the ECW fans. These are the ECW fans who've gone about work rate and how wonderful everything is. They'd be at those WWF shows. We saw them all in the front row there. They'd bought the tickets. Vince had their money.
But that's the point. They were marks for Sid.
They were marks.
New York crowd likes the man's man attitude. There are some cheers for Steve Austin when he comes out too. They're not as overwhelming as the Bret ones, obviously, because Bret's still the fully fledged babyface. Steve Austin does do a very good promo on this show, and we have to talk about the match itself, which is an absolute classic. This is, by the way, Sid's best match ever, so not that's saying a whole lot, but Bret Hart and Steve Austin here, fantastic match. Love this match.
I think in many respects it's a forgotten gem.
I don't think a lot of people know.
But in terms of the wider, I mean, we know, people that we'd speak to on message boards know, but in terms of the mythology, if you like, it tends to be a forgotten match. Largely because the Mania 13 is so good. That's where everyone's mind instantly goes. But I think it's an absolute classic in my mind. Though I will say, and Brett did reference this in his book, there are a lot of sort of subtle jibes and digs throughout the commentary from, not so much from JR, but from Vince.
Certainly
in
from
particular.
Vince. Yeah, there's the one weird, the one that I always thought was really weird at the end of the match when Jim Ross says, "I think Bret Hart and this night could have beaten either Sean or Sid," and Vince goes, "I completely disagree."
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's sort of Vince's passive aggressiveness coming through.
Yeah, but I think it's probably the next night on Raw, but this presentation of Austin is again kind of, it's maybe a bit of a myth that's been presented in retrospect, because what was the line? I think JR says something like he puts over Bret, and Vince pretty much says, "Yeah, but look how much trouble he had with that only Steve Austin."
Yeah, that's a, I never liked that line. That's a strange line.
But JR is the exact opposite on that coach, because he's you can tell it's sort of it's one of Jim's guys. He's going really hard for Austin during that match.
I bet he is.
that sounded so much better in my head.
Everyone, when they think of Austin Bret, they always think of the WrestleMania 13, so they kind of like put the Survivor Series match by the wayside, which is a real shame. Austin's entrance,
it's a great look on his face.
Where you got like the city skyline as the entrance, and they part, and just like he just walks in, and like the way the lighting's like,
is that
on
smoke,
a bit of smoke, and he just kind of walks through, and he just kind of looks at the camera, and just does this kind of like smug but like pissed off look, and you just think like, yeah, all right,
this is the guy.
This is the fucking guy, obviously, son of a bitch. But he uses the $1 million dream and stuff like that, which is kind of like referencing like
Ringmaster
and so on. And then just the finish as well, because obviously it's building up to the finish, which is the redo of WrestleMania 8. I remember watching that and going like, "That's the Mania 8 finish. That's fucking awesome." I didn't hate the fact that he just blatantly ripped off a classic finish, because it just like it kind of worked. It's just like, well, from a logic standpoint, it's like if someone's put you in a hold and your idea of a counter worked before, well then guess what, it's going to work again when it's someone that didn't see that counter in the previous WWF. The psychology of it, I absolutely love that match and the finish. I thought it was really good.
It's Bret, master psychologist.
Yeah, Bret's awesome.
Yeah, and he's got the excellent hand to work there with him as well in Austin.
Yeah, Austin was with him every step of the way. Other thing of note here, Rocky Maivia debuts on this show, which we can't, and the New York crowd, who by the way does not like Shawn Michaels, does chant Rocky here.
Yeah, it's not the die Rocky die and Rocky sucks chance he'd come to get in later months. It's surprising now when you look back at it to think how quickly the audience in general turned on Rock. But on that night, like you say, in New York, where they can be an arsehole crowd when they want to be, they gave him a chance.
Buying this tape and watching it and thinking and seeing Rocky Maivia's name on there and knowing that, like, oh, for a brief time he was known as Rocky the Rock Maivia, looking forward to seeing the Rock on this tape as I'm watching it back, to then be confronted as the Skyline part
with
the butchest lesbian I've ever seen, flopping his hands around like fucking Valvina stole that off him, and just going, "What the fuck is this?"
Oh no, at this point he's the blue chipper that Sonny's got the hots for.
Yeah, I know. Furnace and the Farm debut on this show as well, even though they don't really become any kind of a factor really moving from this point. Impressive debut, I felt at the time. Actually, one of the more fun shows, I thought, during this period of time.
I really enjoyed that opener. Yeah. I thought Furnace and the Fun looked very good in it. Unfortunately, there's no name recognition with the crowd, and that they're not familiar with them. And in the way that Rocky was heavily publicised with vignettes prior to Survivor Series, there'd been very little for Furnace and the Fun, so the crowd weren't with them, which was a shame, but I thought, all in all, they looked very polished, and I was expecting them to win the tag belts.
No,
how foolish I was.
Also, an other note on this from when I watched it back is Sonny's fucking scorching hot.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly on this show. And the commentary with her and JR, I always find it funny. I always laugh at the bickering of those two. And just JR seems like uncomfortable a little bit. And he's just.
JR's got kind of.
Hold on, how comfortable would you be if you look to your right hand side and you see Vince dancing with Sonny? That's enough to unsettle any man. Especially knowing Vince is sorted.
Oh yeah, JR has, again, he's continuing his kind of heel thing here, and he's getting some fucking good zingers here. Flash Funk is also on this show, and Joe gets the line out, "The red and yellow never looked so good in the garden," which is just a funny little line.
Flash, just like last week, Flash Funk, another guy that I used to like to bring in. And
loved Scorpio. I was so hoping for great things from Scorpio in the WWF, and again, just fucking cast as a nothing guy, just like the stalker. Yep. November 18th, Nitro. Eric Bischoff is in the ring and says that he can't put together this match with Roddy Piper. Piper makes his debut. Bischoff's caught out and he turns heel and joins the New World Order. Let's talk about this now when we move on to the next bullet point. Bischoff joins the NWO. Everyone's thoughts at the time or in retrospect, whatever you want.
To me, the perfectly logical move. It helps. Kieran referenced earlier that there'd been sort of subtle hints or suggestions in the way he'd been conducting himself with the Savage interview, the way he'd been missing off TV, and it just, it all tied in nicely and explained everything that had gone before. You think, well, how would these guys be able to get into the building prior to the ticket one where they actually put tickets? How would they have got into the building before then? How do they get into the production truck? How do they manage to do anything that they've done beforehand without someone on the inside who isn't a wrestler? And Bischoff, who was at the best of times could be grating on the commentary as the babyface announcer, manages to merge perfectly into the smug heel prick that in large parts he was at that time. he basically gets to play himself on TV, and it works beautifully.
Yeah, he gets to come out and brag and just be Eric Bischoff. It's fantastic. I honestly can't remember how I felt at the time, but he was the perfect guy for it. And at the time, I never did think DiBiase was right in the role.
Really?
I just didn't like DiBiase in the position. I guess he was supposed to present as kind of a bit of a backer, but it wasn't the focus like he should have been in the position. Whereas when Eric's in the position, he is the boss. He said it's ego, but it was the correct story to tell. So it was a much better fit for me.
Yeah, I thought the combination of Hogan and Bischoff douching it up together.
But basically, as soon as Bischoff came along, it completely nullified Ted DiBiase and his involvement, and it quickly went downhill from there. It's kind of obvious this was the guy who signed Hogan anyway in 94. So it just kind of like makes sense that he's actually the guy pulling the strings for Hogan, you know, sorted out the music for them and everything.
And he was always the PR face for the company when they were doing the press conferences for the launch of Nitro and all those sorts of things. So, you know, even if fans weren't on the inside, you know, it wasn't hard to sort of put two and two together and imagine Bischoff in that role.
The NWO hour of Nitro will be the first hour, because the theory at WCW is that people watch the shows now mainly for the New World Order. So they want to put the NWO head-to-head with Raw, and Eric Bischoff wants to be on the air at the same time as Vince McMahon. It's that simple, and the heel turn has nothing more to it than that. That is the idea, is that they were going to do the head-to-head hour, and Bischoff just wanted to be on commentary when Vince was, to fuck with him. On Raw, Steve Austin, the night after Survivor Series, remember? Steve Austin versus Mankind, heel versus heel match. Really odd kind of mix here. The main event was a fucking awful Sid promo, so there you go, you get what you deserve.
That he's still bitter about that.
Not that I'm bitter about it. I've already told my story about when I had to watch him in the main event at my first ever live wrestling show in Birmingham when he pinned Farouk in 90 seconds for the WWF title.
Oh, that's good, that's a long match for him.
Yeah, well, I didn't get to see Sean, but got to see that. So there you go. 3.2 for Nitro, 2.4 for Raw. So coming off Survivor Series, still not much of a jump here for Monday Night Raw. We go, quite naturally, to the WCW's pay-per-view, World War III, on November 20th. This is where we have the Hulk Hogan-Roddy Piper hip attack angle, where Hulk Hogan acknowledges that Roddy Piper's had a hip replacement. The NWO kind of surrounds him. They hold up the kilt and show the surgery scar. One nice little nod here to the WWF, where Piper says that he taught Vincent how to fight, so don't even try it with me.
I don't know. There was just something about it that I just kind of like, oh, this is a little uncomfortable. It's all right kind of referencing it, but then kind of like just showing it, like they're just surrounding him and it's just like embarrassing him. It's just like, oh, he's not even fighting back. It's like he's going, oh, he's an old man. He's an old man with a hip replacement and there's the scar to prove it. It's like, and we're supposed to get behind this guy that he's like going to be like, you know, the replacement for Savage apparently. You're like, yeah, right. He's lifted up his skirt and showed you his scar. You know, it's like, nah, uncomfortable.
We got the real crux of that one there because he mentioned Savage. So we know why it really bothers him that much. But to G's point, I wasn't the biggest fan of this angle.
No?
I felt like it dragged an awful lot.
It did go on.
Went on too long for me. And to the point of where you're trying to sell a main event and sell a real fight, I don't have a problem with if they're going to reference a hip replacement, then by all means then show the scar, because it just adds credence to it. You know, there's some legitimacy to it, then it's not just a, you know, bullshit heel promo. But when you're trying to sell a fight and what they dubbed at the time the fight of the century, if I'm not mistaken,
the war that didn't settle the score first time,
yeah, if you're going to do that, I'm not particularly sold on showing a guy with a hip replacement if you're trying to set up some sort of legitimate fight with, to show someone so weak and in the sense of trying
Hogan
to get
hits him in the hip with a chair.
You're trying to, and you're trying to get people to pay good money to watch this. I think you've thought of, you're going with something that's gritty and real there, but for me it misses the point.
If they just did it a little differently, if it was something like they mentioned the hip replacement, and they then show it to actually show you that it's real. I think I would have been a lot more better with it if they mentioned it and then Piper showed it himself, and he just kind of like, so I got hit replaced. What, this? You're talking about this? And go, this isn't going to stop me.
This
scar isn't going to stop me. That's fine, because that's the baby face showing you himself that he's battle scar, but he doesn't give a shit. My problem is when you got the heels surrounding him. It's Hogan lifting it up like they're in a fucking playground, and it's just lifting his freaking skirt up, and it's just kind of like, oh, look at his scar and stuff. It's just like it does nothing but demean everything that they're trying to maybe achieve with Piper. Well, it would have been a lot better if Piper did it himself
and said, fuck it, doesn't matter.
Yeah, fuck it, I don't give a shit.
And if the company was cold, they could ill afford to bury a baby face in that manner. But as we mentioned before, the company's hot, and when you're hot, you can get away with so much for a certain period of time.
Moving on to some other notes about this pay-per-view. 10,000 fans in the building, a 0.55 for 138,000 buys, so this does not beat Survivor Series, key to note. Great Ultimo Dragon Rey Mysterio match to kick off the show, a lot of fun there. And the Giant wins the 60-man Battle Royal.
You say about the great opener there again. I was just thinking when you were talking about the Piper Hogan angle, that epitomises, I think, how I felt at the time. Obviously, I was, you know, the WWF... indoctrinated young man I was, and as Carl drops a beer can. but it was like, on one show you've got like these old guys showing their scars, and on the other show with great undercards, and then obviously WWF you've got all these fucking atrocious gimmicks of guys I used to know, but up top you've got Brett, Austin and Shawn. Obviously Britt and Austin together, and Shawn working miracles with Sid, and that's kind of like epitomised how I felt at the time. And it's like, it's always that, you know, that dynamic would never go away, really.
And in truth, WCW as a company never did anything to dispel that as a viewpoint, did they? It was very much the template for their shows going forward.
I just want to say, I hate World War 3 Battle Royal,
the 60 man.
Yeah, I hate it.
The camera angles, I find the way they shoot it is fucking horrible.
It's just horrible. I've never been a fan of Battle Royals anyway. I like Royal Rumbles, but I've never been a fan of Battle Royals. It just always comes across as complete clusterfuck to me. But then to times it by three, and then, as you said, to do this thing where you got like a split screen of like three different cameras with three different commentary teams,
and they're just going teams which include Lee Marshall,
and just kind of like thinking like to Shivani and Heenan or whatever, and then it's just like, oh, this is the action in ring one. Let's move over to the action with Eric Bischoff and da 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 da, and whatever, and it's just going back and forth between everyone. You're just there going like, oh, just get to the final 10 already. It's just like, why can't you just have 10? Just start with 10. The 10 big names that everyone actually gives a shit about and actually knows that have a chance of winning the battle. Who actually thinks, you know, freaking Scotty Riggs is going to win this shit? You know, it's like...
Well, they're such a mess. And the thing you mentioned there, who thinks Scotty Riggs is going to win it, I'd venture to ask the question, does anyone realise Scotty Riggs was even in it?
Yeah.
It's basically bodies flying everywhere. You can't focus on anything. And as we've said before around this table on previous podcasts, Battle Royals are the shits. So serving three up in one night is never the way to go.
I like Battle Royals when I was a kid. I have to out myself here. A couple of weeks of pretty wank TV follow here, but we'll get to the key points anyway. November 25th, Nitro. Your birthday, Kieran. Eric Bischoff.
Cards now, people.
Eric Bischoff gives his explanation about why he joins the New World Order, saying that after he received the powerbomb, he decided that he would rather join the force than fight against it. So that it did acknowledge the fact that the powerbomb took place.
Okay, that's pretty good.
So at least they had something.
Was
there
that the speech where it ends with like the "you're either with us or against us"?
Yes, it is, because the NBO membership drive begins here, and it has Marcus Bagwell turning heel on Scotty Riggs and joining the New World Order. What do you think about the membership drive? We'll come to the other people who sign up shortly, but Marcus Bagwell.
I'm very, very brief. In terms of Marcus Bagwell, from the very brief bits that I've seen of the All-American males.
Just American males.
American males.
American
males.
All American males. American males. American males.
The head movement was brilliant. You won't see it, but it was epic. But it was just anything in terms of Bagwell, anything was an upward move from that tag team. So in terms of that, whilst for the NWO angle is obviously diluting it, for Marcus Bagwell, it was a move in the right direction.
Were you an American Males guy or a Stars and Stripes guy?
I was a Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio guy.
Outside of Bagwell's mother, no one's given a shit about an upward move for Bagwell in about 20 years.
I'm going to say something that you're not going to like, Carl.
Oh, go on.
I have a really weird, polarizing feeling about Buff Bagwell during this period of time, because he was an obnoxious dick. And I didn't hate him at first when he joined the NWO. I didn't think he was great, but I didn't hate him. There's just something about it. He's finding himself. He's a cocky heel. He looks good. He wasn't working bad here. He wasn't the fucking goon that he would later become. Not great, but considering some of the other guys that joined the New World Order, he didn't offend me compared to some of the other schlubs.
He's not the worst offender by any means, but
don't get me wrong, about 6 months later, I'd probably feel very differently.
Oh, absolutely. But he's not the, in terms of this recruitment drive that they go on, he's not the worst example of it. There are far worse that we'll get to. But it's the first real, from the outside looking into me, it's the first real warning sign.
Well, we'd had a few on the previous podcast, and we were kind of debating whether or not it really was wise to put the Giant in the New World Order, and if Virgil really merited a spot.
I don't really want to defend Virgil, because I wouldn't put him in the spot by any means, but there was at least the time with DiBiase. There's a bit of a tenuous link there. The Giant, whilst I think we were in general agreement we wouldn't have put him in, at least it's in WCW terms, it's a prestige name going into the group, or a prominent name.
Yeah, just, a major turncoat.
It'd just been world champion recently, so it was a big name going in. When you start the recruitment drive, and you start with Bagwell, and it goes on further, when you start flooding the group with just insert mid-card name here, that's when you start to have the problems, and we can all picture those big promos where there's close to 30 guys in the ring and they're all trying to hog some camera time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it all just looks a giant mess. And this is the first real warning sign, I think.
I think why probably Bagwell, it was actually probably more acceptable than any of the other dross that came afterwards, is from my memory and the bits that I've seen, is everyone else that kind of joined, it didn't really push them forward as like a character or anything like that. It didn't help them develop any sort of extra dynamics to them. Whilst for Bagwell, it did. It changed his whole persona completely.
Yeah. Bagwell, in the Blockbuster.
Absolutely. So him actually joining the NWO was an actual movement for his character, while everyone else, he just joined just so they could get a t-shirt on.
They put the shirt on and that was it.
Because it makes sense that he joined and it worked for him.
Well, he was an out... To Liam's point, he's an outgoing, cocky individual, so it merits it in that regard. And they did put just some completely bland fuckers in the group when they did this recruitment drive. But no, on a personal note to Marcus Bagwell, I'd have stuck you up on the forklift with your mother and left you there.
We spend way too much time talking about Marcus Bagwell.
It's the only time we are.
I'll keep it short. Bagwell in the NWO. Career movement for him, bowel movement for everyone else.
There we go.
The main event of this Nitro was Mangan the Barbarian versus Harlem Heat, which the NWO, much like the viewers, were sick of and just ran in and beat everybody down. November 25th on Raw, Shawn Michaels does an interview talking about losing the World Championship. Bret Hart wrestles Owen Hart on free TV, and the main event is Mark Mero versus Billy Gunn.
And we've got Sonny fawning over Rock, I think.
Yes, once again.
In an amazing top, and she bounces quite beautifully.
Yeah.
Raw does a 2.1. A 2.1. So again, that whole thing of Vince buying with this whole big contract, Brett's on TV wrestling, 2.1, no movement there. Nitro does a 3.1, again wins by a full point.
But I will say, the way you described that to me there, what was the main event again for Raw?
Mark Mero versus B Gunn. Actually, I should specify Billy Gunn.
Yeah, but yeah. Which
God damn it.
Not to sound redundant here, but I'm going to anyway. This lack of direction from the company, when you've got Bret and Owen, if you're going to put Bret and Owen on free TV, that has to be your main event.
No, it's on first.
It makes. I can appreciate the theory is probably hot start, going up against the first
just
hour,
keep them.
Going up against the first hour of Nitro. But when you sort of when you do that straight out the gate, and what you've got to follow it up with is that, you know, that sort of that you know, I don't really need to go on too much, do I? It sums up the It sums up the rudderless nature of the company.
I've got to say, though, I kind of got a kick out of heel Billy Gunn. I thought he was quite funny. Also, Bradshaw as well.
Yeah, Justin Hoare.
Yeah, Justin Hoare with Uncle Zeb. I can't remember when it was, but they did a backstage promo, the two of them, and they were just wildly entertaining. I was like, how did these guys not get more promo time? But if you saw Bradshaw, his fat ass wobbling all over the shop, it's quite understandable, I guess.
So moving on to the next week here, December the 2nd, Nitro now starts at 7:55 each week to counter the 7:57 start of Raw. An absolutely worthless card. It ends with Sting versus Rick Steiner, which actually doesn't become a match. It's more of an angle with a baseball bat. Nash, Hall and Bischoff pretty much just hijacked the show and didn't tell anybody else, literally anybody else, not the producers, nobody, that they were going to just run to the commentary booth and hijack the thing. So that was a very kind of spur of the moment weird decision. Meanwhile, on Raw, main premise of this show is that they were on the UK tour, so they shot an angle in London where Sid defended the belt against Steve Austin. Dave Boy Smith and Bret Hart do a run in and Bret Hart gets beaten up, basically. Nothing too exciting here. 2.3 for Raw to Nitro's 3.4. Very little to take away from this week, I find. But we mentioned before about Eric Bischoff getting to be his real-life arrogant self before. We have an interview here from the Charleston Post-Courier. This is from Eric Bischoff. The nonsense and perception of reality that Vince McMahon, a guy who has admitted to using steroids to try and beef up what was otherwise a scrawny, frail little individual, I think he wakes up in the morning, looks in the mirror, and still sees the 80-pound bird-faced punk that nobody wanted to play with as a kid, and he has to deal with that every day. And the way he's trying to deal with this right now is creating this false perception you're seeing every week.
He's just fucking with him and...
He's intentionally poking the bear is the whole point of this. He's trying to piss him off. I'm sure he's pissed off anyway, but... In an attempt to fill the 71,000 plus seats in the Alamo Dome in San Antonio for the Royal Rumble, the WWF has decided to combine AAA and the WWF to put together two shows in one. The idea is to make the event a joint show, have the AAA show take place along with the Rumble, but have most of the AAA matches not air on the actual pay-per-view itself and just show the WWF matches. So this is the beginning of a tie-in here with AAA, which I guess stems indirectly from the success of the Cruiserweights, which we haven't mentioned that much since June, but have been a very, very strong part of Nitro in constantly churn out matches with Hoovy and La Parka and Psychosis and all these guys. Vince wants a bit of the Cruiserweight action, sees AAA as a method to fill up the Alamo Dome at the Royal Rumble. 71,000 seats is the goal, but this does lead to appearances from Pierroth and Cibernetico, which Rey Mysterio and Psychosis they weren't.
They most assuredly were not.
We're talking about personal jabs back and forth. Shawn Michaels appeared as a guest on a Rochester, New York radio show on December 6th and called Hulk Hogan a worthless human being and a complete piece of shit, which got edited off the show due to the 7-second delay. This was set at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Shawn just doesn't give a fuck. So yeah, he's starting to crack a little bit here, Shawn. We move to December 9th on Monday Nitro, a pretty great promo show. This one's held in the Carolinas. Ric Flair does a great promo here, putting Roddy Piper over huge, and Piper does a good one again, building to Starrcade against Hulk Hogan. We have Bischoff, Hall and Nash coming out. Kevin Green gets in the ring. Pretty great heat here for this for a big angle at the end of Nitro.
Well, the Carolinas is always a hot place to run for WWE, because it had the old tie into to the NWA and Jim Crockett promotions. There was always that synergy there, so they always had the hot crowd. Having Flair there, of course, always helps. If Piper's on his game, you know, there aren't many better talkers in the business than Piper.
Also on the show, Michael Wall Street joins the New World Order.
You know what I said earlier about bland fuckers joining the group? CVK Wall Street.
Big Daddy Wyatt.
Oh, yeah!
Oh, God.
Also, in stuff that would have a bit of a historical note later on in this series, as we'll get to, they aired a video of Chris Benoit and Nancy Sullivan alluding to the idea that Nancy's walked out on Kevin and is having an affair with Chris in real life, even though it's never been made clear on TV that Nancy and Kevin are actually together. Benoit said that he was playing human chess and had the line, "My bishop takes your queen. Checkmate."
Chris Benoit. Didn't make the top 50 list of greatest talkers, but maybe with that one he should have.
Yeah. Vince McMahon counters this with Taker versus Mankind and no holds barred match on Raw. Clean pin for The Undertaker. Raw does a 2.3 to Nitro's 3.1. Raw is just stuck in this quagmire. 2.3, they're not getting anywhere. No matter what they do, no matter who they sign to massive contracts.
Yeah, they obviously keep Bret Hart around, and you're getting little bits here and there of Austin, but the overall product hasn't shifted. It's not shifting enough. And that's why the figures are reflecting that. It's just like they're not doing enough to draw the numbers in.
I think as well, the Bischoff philosophy on TV, although the NWO recruitment drive you mentioned before was primarily because they wanted to do the two, you know, brands kind of thing, as they call it. That element of suspense, like who's going to join next, it's straight up Bischoff Street, and it made for a more added to Nitro being a more dynamic show than Raw. So what are you going to watch each week?
Yeah, and whilst we can look at the sort of the bloat of the NWO in retrospect and the damage it would do long term, at the time, as you say, it's perfectly, it's that suspense filled TV show, and the damage it's done would obviously not be felt until later on.
It's just that simple thing of guaranteeing a heel turn almost every show. It's just like someone will join us. There'll be a heel turn. Try and guess who.
Yeah.
Join in every week.
The NWO Nitro show is slated to start within the next 2 weeks. As you mentioned, Kieran, the reason they're adding a lot of guys to the NWO is so that they have enough wrestlers to fill a 1 hour show without having to put Hall and Nash in the ring for 20 minutes every week, which they don't want to do.
They would have. Who? WCW or
Hall and Nash? Moving ahead.
I don't need a big contract.
December 15th, it's time. The pay-per-view that was named because they thought Vader was going to be the champion going in. That plan was foiled.
If I remember right, so Vader wasn't even on the show, was he?
No. So, Sid as world champion, 0.35 buy rate, 87,000 buys. Once again, good stuff. Sid beats Bret Hart in the main event after interference from Shawn Michaels, Steve Austin, Dave Roy Smith, Owen Hart, and Judy Bagwell. The main thing of note here, Shawn Michaels on commentary was firing comments at Bret Hart, saying he's the most arrogant and obnoxious wrestler in the WWF, and at Sid, saying he was the most expensive piece of luggage in the company, and that if it wasn't for guys like him carrying Sid, he'd be a big zero. Meltzer says you can't argue the point, but it's something new to have the champion of the promotion's total lack of ability used in their own storylines. Check this line out from the Observer. This is really good. I'm just waiting for the day somebody in WCW builds up an angle with Hogan by saying he's won all of his matches because he insisted on booking his own finishes. Maybe we're a couple of years away from that one.
No.
Prognosticated Dave.
Oh, absolutely. But no, it hammers home the point that Sean's really starting to become unraveled here. But I will say, in Sean's defence, you know, he worked miracles with Sid. On this night, Brett was not able to do that.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Its time was certainly not an enjoyable show, except for Foley running around in his straitjacket.
Yeah.
That was gold. And he got getting thrown through the In Your House logo.
How about the arm? This was Terry Gordy's. I don't think he was around much after this. Is the Armageddon match with The Undertaker, which you referenced before. But
I think that was pretty much it. He didn't make it through to 97 with the company, did he?
I don't think so. I don't remember the Rumble or anything like that. So I think they just kind of saw that they just wrote this off. It's a complete failure.
We said before about what. I agree with Carl. Why would you sign Gordy and put him under the mask? Do you think maybe he was influenced by the, well, for me, a bit of a surprising success there of
Mankind?
Foley's Mankind.
I was actually
thinking
the same thing when you mentioned that holiday of taking some people known and stick them under a mask or repackaging them in general. It's like, that's what they did all the time.
Yeah. But you would think, and this is going to sound daft even coming out of my mouth, I know it is, but you would think that they would have the sense to see that the strength of Foley's promos is what gave that character some legitimacy. That character could have quite easily nosedived, especially for anyone who's read Foley's books. I think we all have around the table the initial plans for the getup and how he was going to look. That could
the
have,
mutilator.
Yeah, that was absolute wrestle crap at his finest before Foley interjected himself and had a bit of a say on the way it would go in terms of his look. Whereas obviously Terry Gordy, as great as he'd been in his heyday, was not necessarily at this point, well, wasn't at all at this point.
He was a shell of himself.
He was a shell of himself because of his health issues. The promos that you would have needed to carry the character weren't going to be there. And it was, even though there's a bit of sort of cartoonishness to the Mankind gimmick, the Executioner at the end of 96, when you've got Austin on the same show as a legitimate badass, and you've got the NWO storyline, which is much more based in realism. You know, it shows it up for what it is.
The next night on Nitro, Eric Bischoff and Ted DiBiase host the first hour in what was the unofficial start of the NWO Nitro Hour, even though there weren't any new graphics, and the matches involved basically mainly non-NWO wrestlers. Meltzer notes that Bischoff was so incredibly obnoxious as an announcer that based on this show alone, he did enough to win the Worst Announcer of the Year award every year until 2000. Masahiro Chono joins the New World Order on this show, which is basically an angle to set up the fact that New Japan were going to do their own NWO angle, and this is a way to give some credit and some credence to that. Right after he joins the New World Order, Chono loses by disqualification to Chris Jericho. Strange booking, writes Dave. In the main event of this show, Mengen Barbarian went to a 1 minute no contest with Hall and Nash when everyone and their brother jumped into the ring to start a WCW vs NWO brawl. During the melee, which was just, this was just a chaotic angle, Big Bubba and Scott Norton joined the New World Order. Sting comes down from the rafters, but the WCW side thought he was with the NWO, and Arn and Mongo attacked him, with Rey Mysterio jumping on his back. Sting then throws him off and simply walks away as the show ends, the brawl going on in the ring. But it's just the most weird and underwhelming way to have, like, there's this big giant brawl, and then Bubba just starts beating up the Dungeon of Doom, and no one's really looking. Scott Norton comes in and starts attacking Ice Train, and nobody cares. And then they just say on commentary, I guess he's in the NWO too. It's like, oh, things, I missed this angle. When we were watching the tapes live, I didn't see this angle. And I remember at the next Nitro, they all come out together. And I was thinking, when the fuck did these guys join the NWO? And this was the real clowns piling out of the car at the circus kind of a moment.
Yeah, and you've got the what would become very much the company's forte in ending Nitros from here almost to the end of time.
We're out of time, folks. See you next week. Over on Raw, there are NWO chants during Sid's promo and in the fake Razor and fake Diesel match. Who could have possibly foreseen such a thing?
That was the one I was going to bring up, was the during the fake Razor and Diesel. It was just like, how fucking stupid do you have to be? Like, obvious.
Also on the show, Steve Austin wrestles Vader in another heel-heel match, which ends in a disqualification. A really weird deal. They keep putting him in there with heels. It's almost as if they know where they're going already.
I'm telling you, I'm adding this to the conspiracy corner list. Austin was a face from the start and they knew it.
They knew that he was going to be the baby face. Yeah. This will take you back. After the Milton Bradley Karate Fighters Tournament match. You remember this?
Yeah.
How they would do this fucking stupid toy endorsement thing on every Raw. They did the tournament match between Lawler and Sable. Goldust and Lawler were left alone in the ring after a big brawl, and Lawler asked Goldust if he was queer. Goldust says no and turns babyface and punches Jerry Lawler.
Yeah. You know, like, what? Queer. Yeah. Babyface pop when he says no.
Yeah, babyface pop when he says no, much like Chuck and Billy. And much like Chuck and Billy, this character fucking dies for a good while after they do this turn.
It's funny that they we mentioned earlier that Goldust's jets have pretty much been called following the losing the belt to Ahmed.
Yeah,
you know, he'd had that sort of, he still had a bit of an association with Mankind. He wrestled, I think he beat Mero on SummerSlam.
Yeah,
but he'd done nothing of real note up until this point, and then they turn him face. The edginess to the character immediately goes.
Yeah,
and it would. It would never be refound, unfortunately.
The main event of this Raw is Billy Gunn versus Bart Gunn. So there you go. And this is the weird angle, if you remember this, with a fake broken neck. They do this, again, similar to the angle a year before where they tried to tease a real injury as they go off the air. They tried to tease that Billy Gunn had broken his neck live in the ring.
Oh, yeah, and that, didn't they get the wives?
The wives got involved. Yeah, a really strange angle to do, I thought. Again, that goes on last. Raw does a 2.3 to Nitro's 3.2. So yeah, still pretty much the ratings are telling the same story every week here. If you thought that M Wall Street was bad, it is thought that Tatanka will be debuting with WCW shortly and become a member of the New World Order. God. Yeah. Randy Savage is set to re-sign with WCW. It is said that he was very unhappy with WCW's offer, but that it was still better than the WWF's offer. So they did actually make a play for him, but it's a bit of a half-hearted one. I guess after they went all in on Brett, they didn't have that much spare cash around. So yeah, there you go. Randy Savage is coming back. December 23rd on Nitro. The show ends with Hulk Hogan doing an interview saying that Roddy Piper was coming out, but it's actually Eric Bischoff dressed in a kilt. Then the real Roddy Piper comes out, but in typical Randy Savage-esque fashion, the entire NWO comes out and beats him up.
Pattern. I sense.
Yes, a pattern is emerging, isn't it?
Yeah, the destruction of all the babyfaces constantly, with not a single bit of babyface shine or kind of anything to really get behind them other than promos. At this point, is it starting to kind of wear on you when you're watching these things? Is it kind of. Is it a detriment at this point? Because we talked before about how, you know, that initial period, that third quarter that we've talked about last show, about how heat, that's the way you need to book it in the beginning. Are they stretching this out too far in your eyes now, by this point?
I think it's another one of them things where they didn't give a shit because of how well they were doing, but some people, maybe it's obviously the partisan thing again, you're waiting for it to fail and you're going to point in future and say, it was always there. It's like Santa with muscles or these things, you know, the old guys, although Piper did a couple of buy rates. It's one of them things, like, it's not hurting now, but you know it's gonna stack up and when it hits a tipping point.
If they run with this as a pat hand forever.
Yeah.
We look at it in the prism of a general wrestling storyline that's heat, heat, heat. The babyface have got to have their comeback at some point. But Bischoff's on an entirely different wavelength to the wavelength. And the way in which we and the rest of the fans would look at it, Bischoff's thinking brand, own show. If I'm doing this, you know, you can see the logic. I've got to make them strong. Otherwise, it's a doomed brand from the start when we properly launch NWO Nitro. So he's sort of caught betwixt and between with that. I don't have a problem. Even at this point, I don't have a problem with the heels getting the heat. I think it's gone on longer than you would normally associate with a wrestling storyline, but it doesn't bother me. I think the bloating of the group is more of an issue to me than the heels getting too much heat on the baby faces.
Talk about fan base as well. I think you said it before already. NWO merchandise was outselling everything else in the company. So, I mean, are they even heels already?
Yeah. In many ways, they'd gone past that point of acting like heels, hadn't they? It wasn't so much.
Yeah, it wasn't
heel in the storyline sense. They were just being prickish and having a good time at the expense of pretty much everyone.
I mean, and they'd had moments here on some of these nitros where they had planted fans in the crowd with NWO signs and banners to try and create like a fan movement for the NWO. So by no means were they trying to pretend that the NWO was this universally hated group. They were trying to treat it on television as a group that has their own fans, because it's hard to ignore the NWO shirts that are in the crowd. So it's just the way it is. It's part and parcel of that kind of an angle. But we mentioned before Nitro with Hogan, Piper, and Bischoff in the NWO beatdown on Raw to counter this. Mark Mero versus Triple H, Rocky Maivia versus Salvatore Sincere, another Sid promo, Piroff and Cibernetico versus the New Rockers, and in the main event, Bret Hart versus Bogner.
How did this company survive?
Raw did its worst number in history with a 1.5. Against the Nitro's 3.1. The Nitro for Raw is the lowest for any WWF programming dating back to Monday night shows on the USA Network in the early 80s. In men 18 to 49, Nitro had a 71 to 29% edge. So this is a real evisceration week.
This is an absolute obliteration. I think it could be, though, don't quote me on this, you'd probably have a better handle on the numbers than me, Liam, but is this the first time we're going head to head without any sort of preemption or any sort of messing around with times that the show aired? Is this the first time that Nitro has more than doubled the rating for Raw?
Yes, it is.
It's one of a small handful, isn't it?
No, you're right on the money. From all accounts, the deal to bring in Bam Bam Bigelow fell through. You may remember we mentioned this on the last podcast. Bigelow was supposed to join the NWO. Bigelow turned it down, with one main reason being that Kevin Nash is there and he never liked him in the WWF. So that's the end of that. Tatanka is also a question mark, so very, very sad. I know that both of you Tatanka fans out there never got to see him in that NWO shirt. You're very sad. Funny note from the Observer here, completely out of context. Lord Steven Regal knocked out Van Hammer at DDP's Christmas party. Attaboy, Regal.
Well done.
Which leads us to December 29th, WCW Starrcade, Hogan versus Piper, a 0.95 buy rate, 238,000 buys, the best buy rate of the year for WCW, 9,000 fans in the building, sold out 2 weeks in advance, and scalped tickets were going for $200, which was unheard of for WCW back then. Piper beats Hogan with a sleeper in the main event of this show.
Hang on. Is this the match when Piper explicitly says he come up the steps?
Yes.
Yep.
And it's not a fucking title match?
Yeah. Yep.
Fucking stupid baby faces.
Though I will say, this is the first show where the baby faces get any sort of semblance of fight back.
And they're made to look stupid at the end of it. Well,
Piper's made to look stupid, I grant you. But at least for a night, there are examples where the baby faces get one over the NWO. Piper beats Hogan clean, which, title or no title, I think shocked everyone. Certainly shocked me when I heard about it. Luger gets a win over the Giant.
Yep.
And again, you're teasing the element of Sting because he leaves the bat in the middle of the ring.
Whose side is he on?
Luger gets there first and uses it on the Giant for the win. So there are finally some examples of WCW getting one over the NWO.
Yeah. Good show, actually. Ultimo Dragon and Dean Malenko is a really good match to start the show.
I'd forgotten. I watched that three or four months ago. I'd forgot how great that was, because this was at the time as well where Dragon had all the belts.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love
He's got the Jake on. He had him in World War 3 too.
Yeah, I love Ultimate Dragon.
Jushin Liger versus Rey Mysterio is also on this show. Not as good as you would think on paper. The crowd didn't really seem to be with it, to be perfectly honest. Eddie Guerrero wins the US title from DDP after the NWO interfere and attack Diamond Dallas Page. So I guess they got sick of the indecisiveness and they send a message here. And obviously this plays into an angle next year. The next night's the final Nitro and Raw of this year. The Giant turns back with WCW. He asks for his title shot that he earned at World War 3. Hogan's at the start of the show. Hogan says, "Hey, relax, guy." The end of the show angle is the NWO are once again beating up Rowdy Roddy Piper. Hogan asks Giant to give him a choke slam, and Giant says no. Hogan slaps Giant. Giant snatches Hogan by the throat and asks for a title match. Hogan then says yes, which ends up happening. It's sold out next year. Then he sicks the NWO on the Giant, and they kick his ass to end the show.
Paul White has pretty much had the career gimmick that he's bipolar, isn't he?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. I was about to say, this isn't the first, and it's by far not the last time Paul White will be turning.
Flipping and flopping all over the place. Yeah, they'd actually sowed the seeds for this on Starrcade, where Giant had kind of indirectly kind of fucked up in the main event with Hogan and Piper, and they kind of sowed the seeds there that Giant's not really in perfect sync with Hogan. Over on Raw, we get a face-to-face with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. Bret Hart rips on Shawn and says he promised to carry the title with prestige and class, but never came close. He said that if you're not 14 and female, you don't get into Shawn Michaels, and referred to the current gimmick of attempting to portray Shawn as a man's man by asking whose man Shawn was.
Mine.
There's a good angle on the show, actually. It's Farouk and Austin against Savio Vega and Jesse James, the real Double J, Carl. Where James gets laid out and Bret Hart in street clothes takes his place. The Nation does a run-in to back up Farouk, and Ahmed Johnson comes out too. So Ahmed Johnson is back.
For now.
But that's what we get over on Raw. Coming the day after the Hogan Piper pay-per-view match, with a lot of curiosity, Nitro had its biggest win ever over Raw by 2 full points. Nitro does a 3.6 to Raw's 1.6. Apparently there are those at Titan who are pretty shook up about the two straight poor ratings on Mondays, and so they should be. Which brings us to the end of 1996. We are leaving things at a particular low point, which kind of ties us in nicely for where we need to go in 1997. Any kind of final thoughts or takeaways? 1996, what a hugely important year, a fascinating year. It's incredible to see where we were 1 year ago, where things were so even though WCW was starting to get a little bit of attraction at the end. The WF just pulls it right back. It's neck and neck, and this last 6 months that we've talked about has been pretty much all WCW.
Yeah, in particular the last 6 months, because I'm going to say, even going into May of 96, they're trading wins.
Yeah.
You know, some winning margins are bigger than others. I think WCW had some bigger margins of victory.
The deficits were bigger for WCW.
The deficits were bigger, but the last 6 months, when Hogan turns, really, when Hogan turns, they start to separate. WCW is off to the races. WWF, as we said before, is flailing around in the dark. It's quite funny though, even in that 6 month period where it's all doom and gloom for WWF, they found something. Maybe by accident, maybe not. They found Austin. Shawn has got that edginess to his attitude because he's unraveling. But you've got the
which is where he needed to be.
Yeah, which is where he needed to be, and you're getting the makings of sort of DX Shawn, let's say. So you've got something there. You know, Farouk's gone from the black gladiator to the very militant style. So you're getting more of that realism from the WWF now. So they found something, but they're still not quite sure what it is. There's still not a clear direction, and it's harming them in the ratings.
They better fucking hurry up and find it.
So they got to get there quickly. WCW, clear wins, some real big wins to end the year on.
Yeah.
Good pay-per-view business. And even so, the warning signs are there. The NWO's getting bloated. Some very, very strange decisions on Nitro, lack of planning, things that aren't being told to production staff, all the sort of things that we associate with the negatives of WCW in later years are starting to manifest themselves on TV now. So it's quite interesting that despite this gulf, there's still something there that would suggest initially, as you get into 97, that things aren't all rosy in the WCW gone. There's problems that will eventually rear their head.
Yeah, pretty much. That's it, I think. Let's go home. I mean, what else can you add apart from Vince and Bischoff must be in complete polar opposites in terms of mental stability. Well, not mental stability.
No, I think you're probably right.
Yeah, well, say frame of mind. God, Bischoff must be walking. Was he ATM Eric yet, or was he just?
Oh, he's getting there.
Just generally Mr. Billy Big Balls kind of thing.
Yeah, he really was.
And Vince, absolute desperation. But they needed it. Maybe if they didn't have the desperation at this point, they wouldn't have gone all out with things that would pay off for them down the line.
Yeah,
and don't want to that to sound like a good, you know, happy ending. You know, we're wrestling fans, but it just set up the greatest, most interesting period in wrestling history for me.
Yeah, 1996. I find it quite interesting. Certainly more exciting from a WCW perspective, because I think even before the NWO stuff, they had some decent kind of shows and you know, angles and programs and stuff on the show. So I was always a Bret Hart guy more than Shawn Michaels. I'd appreciate it if Bret Hart had been around that summer. Shawn Michaels just always seemed disingenuous. Whilst we see something with Austin, as we're going to move into 97 soon, it's still not skyrocketing him. It's still slow. It's still slow build with him.
The company's not 100% behind him anyway at this point. Yeah. As we said with the comments when he fought Bret, it's. There, I think that. Sorry to interrupt you.
No,
go home. Yeah. Promo, but it was. They were looking for anything at this time. And I think Austin had his little, you know, his month thing with Bret, and would it take or whatever, yeah. or whatever. So they were just. I think they were scratching and clawing, and at the minute, nothing's clicking in the ratings. So.
Absolutely, because it was just like again, like the King of the Ring incident, the Survivor Series, and all the little bits before it with the gun angle and talking to Bret and so on. They're all isolated incidents at the time, because you can't really properly include this into what we're going to talk about next year in 97 and WrestleMania 13, because, you know, that wasn't the original plan for WrestleMania 13 for Bret to face Austin. So we can't turn around and say this now Survivor Series is the beginning of the Austin push. It wasn't. It was still stepping stones here and there, where like Austin's given them quality and Vince is still being blind, and he's still putting Sid, he's still sucking Shawn Michaels off, he's still, like, you know, throwing money at Bret and then regretting it. He's still making huge mistakes when his fucking answer is glaring him right in the goddamn face. And in the meantime, because of his quite blatant ignorance as to what he needs to do and exactly what quality of wrestlers he has, WCW are able to do whatever they want, and they're making mistakes. They've got a hot angle and they're still making mistakes within the angle. They're making decisions that are going to cause almost cataclysmic problems to the company. Bischoff must have been like walking on sunshine, you know, because it's just like he's throwing haymakers and Vince is blocking. It's not even that. He's just slapping him in the face and Vince is cupping his balls and hoping he's not going to hit him there. That's pretty much all it is right now. It's just too one-sided. But 97 is an interesting one, because 97 there's a lot of NWO stuff going on, and obviously with the undercard and stuff, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on there. But also we're going to start going into this exciting Canada versus America angle. So 97 is going to be very interesting when we get around to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff coming here in this series. So I do think it's a great point to end on. WCW hitting a peak here, that the best buy rate of the year, that the huge Nitro victories, and WS is completely slumming it with the worst Monday Night ratings they've ever done. So on that note, I want to thank everybody for listening this far. We will be back next week looking at your all-time favourite tag team. So if you want to get your suggestion, your nomination, and why they are your favourite all-time tag team, why you think they're the best, whatever your argument may be, send them to scgradio@hotmail.com. We'll guarantee to read them on the air next week. As American Males plays us out, for G. John Chase.
Hey everybody, have you seen my balls? They're big and salty and brown.
For Carl Jones.
That's very disturbing, Chase, and no, I haven't.
And for Kieran O'Rourke.
My favourite tag team of all time was me and Carl with your mum, Chase.
And we are out of here. American Males.
American males, American males, American America.